like to speak to you today about some pitfalls of pride. I appreciate your presence here this morning, and I trust that what I have to say to you from the Scriptures will be helpful to you, particularly in a way that is particularly practical to you at this time in your life, perhaps. But pride is something that we all have to deal with. As a matter of fact, pride often stands, you might say it is what essentially stands between us and our in obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Perhaps several weeks ago, or at least earlier this year, I had addressed a lesson entitled Pitfalls of Prejudice. You may recall from that lesson my explanation for a pitfall, which was basically an ancient animal trap. It was a hole in the ground, maybe with some stakes in the bottom, and it had been camouflaged or covered. An animal would come along, not realizing that there was a hole in or pit in the ground there, would fall into the hole and impale itself perhaps on those stakes in the ground, and then the hunter would have his prey. Pride is like that. It can be a real pitfall, and there can be various sources of pride, which I refer to as pitfalls. Pride is worthy of the Christian's serious study and consideration because, first of all, it's prevalent. Everywhere and in everyone, even in himself, a person is going to encounter a problem with pride. We cannot get away from it. We cannot escape it because pride has to do with our own self-interest. And that's hard to get away from, isn't it? So pride and its problems are never farther away than the person himself. It's right there in our hearts. We can't get away from it. So for that reason I say it's prevalent. But also it's perilous or dangerous. You may see a pattern developing here by now. We're going to have a lot of P words in this lesson because, well, I happen to like alliteration. But anyway, we're going to encounter a couple of words. Don't throw stones at me, but they're going to be a couple of big, even outrageous words. But they do begin with P, so I selected them for that reason. But perilous, then. Pride is perilous or dangerous. Proverbs 16, verse 18 says, "Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling." So it is problematical in that respect. It destroys both here in this life, and it destroys a person's soul in hell. So it is perilous. It is also problematical from one particular standpoint that I want to note at this time. It is problematical, or it is a problem, because it can be hard to define, at least in a bad sense. And it can then be hard to identify. People simply don't recognize pride for what it is. We may have a problem with pride, and we may think it's a good thing, or we may not realize that we have a problem with pride because it's not called pride. Or even if it is called pride, it might be something that we consider to be good. For instance, we talk about some good forms of pride. School pride, that's supposed to be good, isn't it? Patriotic or national pride, that's supposed to be good, isn't it? Maybe you could name other kinds of pride that we are proud of. So pride sometimes can be used in at least what we think of as a good sense. So just the word pride itself does, or proud, does not tell us whether something it describes is bad. And that is a problem because we can be guilty of pride and not realize it, perhaps. Pride is equivalent to arrogance or haughtiness. Perhaps those are terms we think of as referring to something that is bad. I mean, do we ever think of an arrogant person as being a good person, or at least good for being arrogant? Pride is that which causes a person to seek to elevate himself over others as if he is more important, and oftentimes at their expense. It is associated with selfishness. It is a form of selfishness. As a matter of fact, I have one of those now I've heard it all moments, or I thought I had heard it all moments the other day. I heard that they have now come up with a movement or a ceremony whereby people can marry themselves. Yes, that's, apparently it is true. I don't think you can do it legally, as far as I know, though that might be coming. But people have a ceremony that they can go through and they can marry themselves. I guess that's the ultimate in egotism. But pride is associated with selfishness, or it is a form of selfishness. In 2 Timothy, the third chapter, beginning with verse 1, we read, "But realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come." And notice the various ways in which forms of pride are referred to in the coming verses. Verse 2, "For men will be lovers of self." That's where it starts, with that interest in self, with that pride. But he goes on to say, lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, form of pride, boastfulness, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents. And let me just drop down to verse 4. He goes on to say, treacherous, reckless, conceited. Conceited, another form of pridefulness. Where does it all go back to? What does Paul start with there in that long list of various types of sins? Starts with people being lovers of self. So, considering all of this, it behooves us to identify and eradicate pride from our lives. Pride is a problem because it covers itself under the guise of other problems. In other words, there may be some expression of sin, but people don't realize that there is pride underneath it. It is the hidden root lying beneath and feeding many sins. In 1 John 2, verse 16, the boastful pride of life is one of the three basic avenues by which people are tempted, John there says. For instance, and just to give you some example, someone might embrace false teaching and promote himself as a champion of some false teaching. Why? Because he really believes it? Well, he may think he does. But also there may be pride behind that. He may be using this false teaching as a vehicle to advance himself and his interest, or to promote himself as a great thinker, as someone who is smart, who saw something that nobody else did. So pride can be behind false teaching. But who would have guessed it in some cases? So again, let me say that it behooves the Christian to be ready to identify and eradicate pride from life by identifying its sources, or what I would call pitfalls. So, from this point on, I'd like to look at seven sources of pride. Round this off to, perhaps we could think of more. This is not an exhaustive list, but these are at least some that are referred to in the Bible, and seven is a nice round biblical number, so we'll round it off to seven. And start with prowess. Prowess is a skill or an ability. And this skill can come in many different forms. Because after all of us, we may not think in these terms sometimes, but all of us have something that we do in which we excel and can do better than others. Now, skills are good, but we've got to be careful how we use them and the attitude that we adopt toward them. Now, people might not think of themselves as having a problem with prowess as a source of pride in their lives, or a certain skill as a source of pride in their a source of pride for them. But if they think of prowess as some ability that they have, if they think they do pretty well, then they might see from that standpoint that they have a problem with pride in this ability. Let me ask some questions to help you understand what I'm getting at. We have to ask ourselves, do we do some things that we do well in order to get praise and recognition and respect from others? Is that why we're doing it? Is that our motive? Do we become jealous when someone does something better than we do? And could that sense of jealousy really be an expression of pride? Do we become resentful if someone is given our job or our place or our position or praise that we think really rightfully belongs to us? Do we resort to criticism to keep someone from looking as good as we do? Are we willing to take the unsung, thankless jobs? Instead, do we want always to have the glamorous jobs that puts us in the limelight and draws attention to us? After all, what might you be more willing to do? Teach and preach instead of cleaning the building? You know, that's not very glamorous, is it? But those are the other jobs, like cleaning the building, preparing the Lord's Supper, mowing the grass or whatever. Those are hard jobs. We don't like to do them, but they can be important jobs too. But they're considered lowly jobs, aren't they? They don't get us praise. Are we willing to do those jobs, even though they don't get us praise? Let me move on to the second source or pitfall of pride. Here's one of those two big words I'm pulling on you. Pulchritude. I would not have used it ordinarily, but I had to have a word that started with a P. It simply means beauty. Beauty. Or if you prefer another P word, prettiness. The love of beauty, or what is appealing to the eye, is a more powerful motive to misconduct than I think many people realize. Again, remember in 1 John 2, verse 16, it is the lust of the eyes that is one of the three basic avenues of temptation. Think about how much we do in order to bring some pleasure to or through our eyesight. Remember that both Eve and Christ were tempted by what was appealing to the eyes. Remember it says in Genesis 3 verse 6 that she saw that the fruit was good for food. She was able to look at it. Apparently it was a beautiful fruit. And then Christ was taken by Satan up to some high mountain and shown all the kingdoms of the world and challenged to fall down and worship Satan in order to have all of these kingdoms, all of this political power. But he was shown all of these kingdoms. Yes, even Christ were tempted through the eyes. Temptation can be exponentially stronger if not only the idea is presented to the mind, but the temptation is shown to the eyes. A lot of people can think in abstract terms about some temptation. Let's say, for instance, you have you love chocolate cake. Oh, you have a real weakness for chocolate cake. If someone put a chocolate cake in front of you, you'd eat the whole thing. And it's problematical because something like that, well, it can lead to problems. That's your weakness. Now, you might be able to talk about chocolate cake. You might be able to say, you know, I have a problem with chocolate cake. I love it too much or whatever. But as long as you're just talking about it, it's not a problem. But what if somebody comes and sets that chocolate cake in front of you, and you're not only just talking about and thinking about chocolate cake, but now you see the chocolate cake? That adds a whole level of temptation there that you had not been dealing with before. That tells us something about the power of sight to add a new level or element of temptation to us. Think about it again for just a moment. If you could go anywhere in the world and see the most beautiful scenery that you could think about, I don't know what it would be. Would it be some South Pacific island like Bora Bora, Tahiti? Maybe it would be the Swiss Alps. Maybe it would be, some lodge overlooking the Smoky Mountains, that green scenery there. Whatever you might think of would be beautiful. Maybe some lodge overlooking the Grand Canyon. I don't know what it would be. You pick. But what if you were offered, a free ticket to one of those places, free lodging, whatever. But the person who offered to you said that there's only one limitation here. During your whole stay there, you're going to have to be blindfolded. Yeah. What's the point in going then? You go there to see those things. And people are willing to spend a lot of money just to satisfy the desire of their eyes. It's not enough just to be there, is it? The whole thing is seeing the beauty of those places. That tells us something about the power of beauty. Now, of course, I don't think there's any particular virtue in ugliness. I don't think we ought to try to be ugly. Ladies, please don't. If you want to put on cosmetics and look a little bit nicer, that's fine with me. I like it. Okay. So I'm not trying to discourage anyone from looking as nice as they can. But beauty becomes wrong when it overpowers and unduly taxes the requirements of spirituality. Proverbs 31, verse 30, warns us about the power and the abuse of beauty. Proverbs 31, of course, in the latter part of the chapter anyway, talks about the worthy woman and praises her and comes down to verse 30 and says, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised." Now, again, this is not saying that we cannot in some way make ourselves look physically nicer, that we cannot beautify ourselves, our persons, our homes, our cars, or whatever. I don't think there's any particular virtue in trying to make things look ugly or not caring about the way things look. We could talk about that, but that's not the lesson this morning. I'm just trying to say that when we attach such importance to that we overdo it, and we start to take away from our spiritual interest, and we sacrifice our souls for beauty, that becomes a problem. One of the saddest things I think I've ever seen, might not sound sad to you, but is to walk home after our assemblies on Sunday morning, and as I'm walking home, I see somebody jogging up the hill. I'm thinking, where was this person this morning? This person thinks that on the Lord's Day, the most important thing he can be doing, or she can be doing, is attending to his or her body and making herself or himself look better physically, instead of being here to worship God. Now, I'm not opposed to jogging and people keeping themselves in good physical shape. Not at all. But not at the sacrifice of our spiritual needs. So, that's a problem. Sometimes people devote much time and energy and money to having beautiful bodies, but not just bodies, but cars and clothes and artwork and houses, but they neglect their souls. I heard on the news just this past week that for the first time somebody paid over $100 million for a work of art by an American artist. And they showed it, and it was one of the ugliest things I've ever seen. I'm not sure what it was, but, I don't think they were really buying beauty, but I guess they were. They thought they were, but it's willing to pay a lot of money for something like that. That's what I'm talking about. Let me move on to a third pitfall of pride, and that is prestige or popularity. People will go to great lengths to have the approval of others. In John 12, verses 42 and 43, it refers to those leaders of the Jews who did believe in Jesus Christ, but because they were afraid they would be condemned by their peers for believing in Jesus, they would not confess Him. Let me read those two verses specifically. Nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in Him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing Him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the approval of men rather than the approval of God. That's amazing to me. They actually believed in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, but even that belief was not strong enough to overcome their desire to have the approval of their peers. Why is it that prestige or popularity, the approval of peers, is so important to us? That's because our self-concept, by that I mean what we think about ourselves, whether we think we're good or bad or somewhere in between, our self-concept is critical to our lives, our very lives. People will actually kill themselves in some cases because they don't have a high opinion of themselves. The biblical example of that is Judas. It says in Matthew 27, verses 3 through 5, that he confessed, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood," because he had betrayed Jesus and led to his condemnation. You know what he did? He went out and hanged himself. Some people cannot stand to live with themselves because they have such a poor opinion of themselves. Now, that ties into the approval of others in this way. It's very difficult for us to think very highly of ourselves when those around us do not think highly of us. Very difficult. And so, on the other hand, we can say, if others approve of us, then it is so much easier for us to approve of ourselves. People need to work for the respect of others, but not for necessarily for their approval. Now, it's not wrong to try to please people. You know, again, there's no virtue in going around and being obnoxious toward people. You don't want to do that. You can't very well influence them for good and bring them to Christ and teach them if you don't behave in a way that, if you will, pleases them or that they approve of. So I'm not trying to say we need to totally ignore how other people perceive us. We need to try to have their approval if we can. But when it comes to the time when we must make a choice between people's approval of us and God's approval of us, we've got to go with God's approval of us. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 33, "Just as I also please all men in all things." And that sounds rather contrary to what I've been trying to say, doesn't it? He tries to please men. Then why does he in other places say, "I don't please men"? He goes on to explain what he's talking about in latter part of verse 33. "Not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved." Now, if he can gain their approval and in that way get a hearing for the gospel of Jesus Christ and teach them so that their souls might be saved, then he will seek to live in such a way that pleases them. But if he has to make a choice between pleasing God and pleasing men, he will please God. You would hope you could do both, but sometimes you can't. The fourth example of I'm not ready to move on to that yet. I'm sorry. Got too far ahead a bit between my notes and the PowerPoint. We need to recognize that others' assessment of us, others' judgment of us, does not make us who we are. Now maybe I'm ready for the fourth one. Okay. Prosperity. Material prosperity is often used as a measure of our success or our worth. Some people think that the prosperous person has achieved his prosperity either because God favors him or simply because he is so much better, he's so much more skillful, he's so smarter, so much more smart than others, I should say, that's why he has gotten where he has gotten. In Luke the 12th chapter, verse 15, just before he gives the story of the rich fool who thought he had it made once he had taken care of his physical necessities, Jesus says, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." Our lives are more than what we have, in other words. We are not less important because we have not because we have less. Okay? If we're poor, that does not mean that we're less important to God or that we are less important than the rich. We need to bear that in mind. And therefore, the person who is not willing to be content with enough, or who seeks and displays his prosperity in order to prove his self-worth to others and to himself, that person is guilty of pride. Paul said in 1 Timothy 6, verses 6 through 11, "We brought nothing into the world. We cannot take anything out of it either. And we came into the world naked, and that's the way we're going to leave." And we ought to bear that in mind as we contemplate the kind of attitude we ought to have toward the material things of this world. They're not going with us. A fifth pitfall of pride is power. When I speak of power, I mean authority, strength, influence, not just how much you can bench lift, but your, for instance, ability to influence others or tell and dictate to others maybe how they ought to live or what they ought to do. Some seek power over others, not for their good, but as proof of their own influence. They reason that they would not have gotten such influence over others if it were not for the fact that they are better than others, they know more than others, therefore they are in this position over them, or they pack such power, or they have such influence because they ought to have such influence. They deserve it. They can do more with it. They're better at it than others. They are just more powerful than others. And their sense of self-worth is confirmed by the acquisition of this power and this influence over others. They think they have risen to the heights of success and power because they are right. Now, this is a form of pride. And it easily leads to abuse. You know, I believe I've seen this in others. Perhaps you've seen it too. Someone begins to gain some influence, and he's not careful, and he begins to wield this influence in ways that are not good, and acquire more power and influence. That's not a healthy situation, especially in spiritual circles within the church. You know, it's interesting that in Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, God gives instructions regarding the king that the Israelites would have. And beginning in verse 19, we note that he says, "And it shall be with him," that is the law, the copy of the law that he has written out by his own hand, "and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes." Notice the beginning of verse 20 particularly. "That his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel." Now, no, this is talking about the king. And the king is required to make in his own hand a copy of the law so that he will become familiar with it. The king is to be humble. Now, can you imagine that? That's almost like a contradiction in terms, isn't it? An humble king? Aren't kings by nature supposed to be very powerful and prideful? Aren't we supposed to humble ourselves before them? But notice that it says here that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, or literally it is brothers. The Israelite king was to remember, listen, even though you're king, you're no better than the other. You're no more valuable. You're no more important than your countrymen. Any of them. Remember that. Because if you ever get to the point where you doubt or forget that, then you're going to disobey the law of the Lord. Because it goes on to say, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment. That's remarkable to me. That God is warning the king of the Israelites to be humble, not to allow his heart to be lifted up above his countrymen, but to remember that he is one of them. He is not to be proud. Because once the king becomes proud, then he becomes abusive. Jerry has already read from 2 Chronicles 26, verse 16, that tells us that King Uzziah apparently forgot this here. What happened when he became proud? Or rather, when he became powerful? Well, when he became powerful, he became proud. He forgot his place. He thought he could, just as well as the priest, go into the temple and offer incense. He was set straight by the priest. It's not your right or prerogative to be doing this. But see, when people become proud of their power, then they can easily slip into some form of abuse, like Diotrephes in the church mentioned in 2 John 9 and 10. He loved to have the preeminence. And he was the one who was deciding who was going to be in fellowship in that church and who was not. Number 6. Here's one of those big words again. I wanted to use the word intelligence. That's what I'm talking about, really, but it didn't start with a P, so I came up with, and I don't know if I can pronounce this word, perspicacity. It's wisdom, insight, discernment, knowledge, and intelligence. It is obvious that those who are smarter than others might, or think they're smarter than others, might find it more difficult to overcome pride. Some people are pretty smart. And, you know, I in some ways I feel pretty small beside them because they are just so smart. I don't have their intelligence. And they realize that they are people of high intelligence. And, oh, it can be so difficult for them to be humble with that great intelligence. Because intelligence, or knowledge, places a lot of power in the hands of its possessors. Now, it's arguable, I think, that intelligence is the single greatest basis of pride that a person has. Remember, and I'll use the King James Version for this quotation. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1 says, "Knowledge puffeth up." Knowledge puffeth up. New American Standard says, "Knowledge makes arrogant." But I remember the way the King James Version puts it. A person who is knowledgeable and he knows it, he has this tendency to get pumped up, puffed up with pride. If you were given a choice, let's just put this to the test. If you were given a choice between, you can be extremely beautiful, or you are handsome, or you can be extremely wealthy. Okay, that's a temptation right there. Or you can be extremely intelligent. What would you prefer? You can only pick one. What would you prefer? Perhaps most people would say, I'd rather be extremely intelligent. Because if I can have intelligence, then I can get myself wealth and even beauty to some extent with my intelligence. After all, if you're ugly or you think you're ugly, at least there's cosmetic surgery. Okay? But there is no cosmetic surgery for, well, stupidity, is there? Nothing can be done about it. But if you have intelligence, then you can make yourself money with your intelligence, make yourself wealthy with your intelligence, and maybe make enough money to do something about yourself physically. I say that to say that's why intelligence can be such a strong temptation to pride. And yet the paradox is that intelligence can be, for this very reason, a source of great weakness. Yes, great intelligence can be weakness because it leads people to become proudful. They begin to think that they're self-sufficient. They don't have to depend upon anybody else, not even God. They think they're smarter than God, if God even exists. Or that they're too intelligent to allow themselves to be lost. Or that they're too knowledgeable to be deceived into believing something as silly as the Bible. Yes, intelligence can get in people's way of getting to heaven. Let's remember, IQ is not a measure of one's importance to God. No amount of intelligence will resolve the world's greatest problems. And that's sin and death. Okay? Intelligence might help us to find cures for certain diseases, solve certain economic problems, this and that. But intelligence is not what it takes to solve the problem of sin and death. No matter how intelligent a person is, no matter what his or her IQ is, he or she will not be able to save his or herself from death by that intelligence. No matter how intelligent a man is, if he does not take what I've just said into account and his need for God, then he's as dumb as a rock, or he might as well be. And let me put it to you this way. Not far from here, we had perhaps the most intelligent man, or someone who is looked at as the most intelligent man in history, living. Actually, I was going to look it up. I don't know where he's buried, but I suspect he may be buried in Princeton or somewhere. But he was there at Princeton. He was a professor. May be buried there, not far from here. Certainly was living there for a time. You know who I'm talking about? Who would you think of as the smartest person who ever lived? We even use his name as a symbol of high intelligence. Einstein, Albert Einstein. But the most important fact we need to know about Albert Einstein, and this is not particularly profound, but here's the most important fact you need to remember about Albert Einstein, and that is that Albert Einstein is dead. No matter how smart he was, folks, his body's in the grave right now. His intelligence did not save him from that. That ought to tell us something. I'll close out with the last pitfall of pride, and that is pedigree. Pedigree refers, of course, to lineage. Some people are very proud of their lineage. They place a great deal of confidence in it as an indicator of God's approval of them. If you talk to some people, they will point to the fact that, there was a long line of Christians from whom they're descended. One time I went to a friend's graduation from law school, and it just so happened that the woman who gave the commencement address was a judge. And as a matter of fact, her name was brought up as a possibility at the time. I think this was back in what was it, 2007 or so. I might be off a year or two. But anyway, her name was brought up at the time. Seems like it was Brown. Her name was brought up as a possibility for a Supreme Court nominee. And I found out that she was a member of the Church of Christ. So I wanted to meet her. And during the after the ceremonies and when refreshments were being served in the library or whatever, I made my way to her. I saw her across the room. I made my way to her, and I got to speak to her a little bit. And I said, "I heard that you're a member of the Church of Christ. Is that right?" And she said, "Yes, I am. Fifth generation." Now, really, I don't that didn't bother me per se. That she could trace her spiritual lineage back five generations. You know, I'm third generation. My grandfather was the first one in the Lord's church. But that could be abused. Some people could say, "Oh, I can't go against my ancestors. Why? We've done this going back. This is what we believe going back so many generations. I would be betraying them to change my views now." What they're appealing to is what we would call pedigree. You know, the Jews did the same thing. And John the Baptist had to tell the Pharisees and the Sadducees, that doesn't count. Your pedigree, who you're descended from, as far as your salvation is concerned, doesn't count for anything with God. In Matthew 3, verse 9, John the Baptist tells these Sadducees and Pharisees, "And do not suppose that you can say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham for our father,' for I say to you that God is able from these stones to raise up children to Abraham." And your pedigree doesn't matter to God. It's what you are in your character that matters to God. The Samaritan woman Jesus met at a well in John, the fourth chapter, seems to have had some of this attitude. Actually, let's just read what she says in verse 20 of John 4. There it says, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. That ought to count for something, she seems to be saying. No, that doesn't make it right. It's a mistake to find comfort and pride in what one's forebears have done if that pride and that comfort stand between us and God. If those forebears did not walk in and model the ways of God. Let me move on to the conclusion. How fundamentally problematical pride is may be judged from the fact that sin essentially owes its existence to pride. In the case of Eve, she saw that the fruit could make her wise. Really, in the case of everybody, that's why in Micah 6 verse 8, we're told to walk humbly with our God. Obedience depends on humility in the Scriptures. And it's indicated in 1 Timothy 3, verse 6, that it was pride reaching out for something that did not rightfully belong to him that was the cause of Satan's downfall in the very beginning. We need to remember that pride does not exist apart from its sources. That is, we're not just proud, we're proud of something. And this is shown by the fact that the proud king of Tyre is said to have found pride in several sources. I won't take the time to read it now, but several of them we've looked at today, and they're specifically mentioned and attributed to the king of Tyre in Ezekiel 28, beginning with verse 2. He was lifted up by power. He was lifted up by his sense of his wisdom. He was lifted up by his riches and even his beauty. So therefore, if a person would not be guilty of the pride which blocks his way to heaven, he would do well to search out his heart. See if there's any prideful way in it, and free himself of that source of pride so that he might have access in humility to the soul's cleansing blood of Jesus Christ. We cannot come to Christ without being humble. The Bible tells us, at least initially in becoming a child of God, we need to express that humility by coming to faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, by coming to repentance, doing away with our sins and eliminating them from our lives, changing our attitude towards sin, by then being willing to confess our faith in Jesus Christ and doing it, and finally by being baptized in a body of water that the blood of Christ might cleanse us of our sins. That's what the Scriptures tell us that we need to do to become children of God. And if you follow that pathway of becoming a child of God, but since then maybe pride has taken over in your heart again, and you've raised up in some way a fist against God in proud defiance, and you recognize that's going to keep you out of heaven if you continue on that pathway, and you want to change, we invite you to come forward, make your needs and your desires known. We invite you to come forward, if it need be, and make your sins known. And let us know that you're sorry for the things that you've done wrong. We would even stand and sing a song in order to encourage you to consider obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let us stand and sing then.